Hi there. This is Jake Morrissey, the much handsomer co-host of Marlon and Jake Read Dead People, letting you know that there won't be a new episode this week. Marlon is nearly at the finishing line of his new book, and in honor of the fact that I'm not letting him get up from his desk until he's done, we thought we'd offer you another chance to listen to the first episode of the podcast, which we call Literary Grudge Match. We'll be back soon with more dead author dissing, so hang tight. And thanks for listening.
Riverhead Books and Read It Forward present Marlon and Jake Read Dead People, a podcast with Marlon James and Jake Morrissey.
I'm very excited to talk about dead people because I love speaking ill of the dead.
It was the worst of times. It was the worst of times.
You know what? I'm not going to defend that book.
Enough about you. Let's talk about what I think.
They're Jane Austen characters. I love that everybody's like, why?
Not a fan of The Hobbits.
I'm about to walk out of this room.
If you're going to be that obvious, why don't you just hit me with a 2x4 and be done with
it? That is some serious shit.
Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the podcast Marlon and Jake Read Dead People, with your hosts, the Man Booker Prize-winning and international best-selling author Marlon James, and me, his editor, Jake Morrissey. On this podcast, we'll be talking about authors, dead authors we like, authors we hate, great books by dead authors, terrible books by dead authors, books we love that you'd never expect us to read, books one of us loves that the other can't stand, books we want you to pay attention to, and books we want to steer you away from with every fiber of our being. Because we're a writer and an editor, we know books, and we have opinions about books and about the people who wrote them. A lot of opinions. Sometimes we'll agree and sometimes we'll disagree, and we're going to be honest. Brutally, unsparingly honest, which is why these authors have to be dead. So, welcome to the first conversation about dead people with Marlon and Jake. Let's get started by introducing yourselves.
That would be me. I'm Marlon James. I'm an author who's very much alive. And I've written a few books, including some that, you know, the said editor, Mr. Morrissey, has even edited.
That's right.
And yeah, I'm very excited to talk about dead people because I love speaking ill of the dead. You know, this whole idea that, you know, the dead should get some respect. I'm like, come on.
See, the truth has always been part of your fiction, whether you know it or not.
You know, Dead or Not Dead, Peyton Place is a terrible novel.
Oh!
You know?
I'm afraid we're going to have to disagree already. But I'm Jake Morrissey. I'm an editor at Riverhead Books. And as Marlon said, we've worked on a couple of novels together, including A Brief History of Seven Killings and Black Leopard, Red Wolf. But enough about us. So let's dive into right now what we're calling Author Grudge Match.
Mm-hmm. This has been going on for a few years.
Yes, exactly. Because this was one of the early seeds of this podcast, which grew from a conversation that you and I started a long time ago about Charles Dickens.
I think it was a fight.
You say tomato, I say tomato. And Anthony Trollope, who were two giants of 19th century fiction.
One more giant than the other,
who lived and worked at roughly the same time in roughly the same place, which was England. And that much is pretty much all we agree on. What we don't necessarily agree on is what books of each author should be read by people, or even whether you should read these old dead guys at all. So, which is your favorite bitch, Charles Dickens or Anthony Trollope?
As a Jamaican, I should have really big issues with Charles Dickens. He's a very, very problematic guy.
Because?
Well, among other things, one of the first Jamaican civil rights movements was the Morant Bay Rebellion, and it was dealt with very harshly, even by British standards, and they can be pretty brutal. But they ended up, I think, executing around 400 people. And this is post slavery.
This is like mid 19th century?
Late 19th century. Yeah. It's like 1865. And it was international, almost worldwide outrage at how it was. It was like a Jamaican Tiananmen Square.
Okay.
And but Dickens was one of the people who supported it.
Wow.
You know, he was like, no, you know, the natives need to be taught a lesson.
They need to be what, in line for queen and country?
Something like that.
Wow.
And you know, it's so on that level, fuck you, Dickens. But
having said that,
since this is a grudge match against Dickens and the, let me leave my criticisms for Trollope for later on in this podcast. But definitely Dickens with all of that. Okay. You know, I am definitely in Camp Dickens.
Well, while I'm a great admirer of Charles Dickens, and you know there are certain novels of his that I think are terrific, I find Anthony Trollope's consistency, I find his ability to look in small ways at big ideas and character for a certain kind of Englishman or English person, readable and compelling. I think, and I realize the issues you might have with Anthony Trollope are, from a reader's point of view and from a literary point of view, I get. But I think that pound for pound, I think Anthony Trollope is more consistent than Dickens. I think he's more sometimes more readable than Dickens, and I think sometimes he's more approachable than Dickens. Mm. So I'm Team Tony.
He sounds like a really boring husband.
Well, I didn't marry him, so I can't speak to that. I can't speak to that.
Consistency is like, why should I marry you? I'm consistent.
Okay. I hope to God that I never say to my, never said to my wife, marry me, honey. I'm consistent.
I'm consistent.
He wrote 6 political novels in over
20. Are those the ones you sent me?
Merry Christmas. I'm sure you opened up every single one of them and read every word.
Jake sent me this huge box. And I think it was at the Barchester.
No, it was the Palliser novels.
The Palliser novels. Yes. I just thought they were black.
Yes. Well, they were the ones that they, I think Oxford University Press published them, but I could be wrong about that. Anyway, they're small paperbacks that were about Plantagenet Palliser and his wife, Glencore.
His name is Plantagenet.
His name is Plantagenet Palliser, and he's the heir to the Dukedom of Omnium. And he is a liberal politician in mid-19th century England.
Real slice of life.
Real slice of life. And he marries a woman who doesn't love him because
His name is Plantagenet.
He was told to. A woman.
What did she call him? Planty?
She called him Planty, yes. And I wish I was making this up. And she was almost as wealthy as he was. So together they venture forth on the political and social world of mid-19th century England as liberal politicians, as Trollope was. He was a liberal himself as opposed to the conservatives. And tells a story of how England evolved over those 20 years through the mm-hmm. characters of the and he has a kind of ne'er-do-well Irish MP who comes to England named Phineas Finn, who gets himself accused of murdering a member of the government. There's various children who grow up who have their own adventures. Plantagenet himself, whose greatest ambition. Planty, whose greatest ambition was to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, when he becomes Duke of Omnium, that's the one position in England in English government that a peer is not allowed to hold. So this is a guy who worked all of his life to become a Chancellor of the Exchequer who can't be Chancellor anymore because he's now a Duke.
I'm sorry, you know what? He deserved that.
because
really,
of an accident.
That's your job. Your accident my of job is I want to be basically the Queen's money bags.
Well, you know, he was about, well, for him, about the being a liberal politician, for him it was about government is to curb the baser desires of people so that we can all live more equitably.
Mm-hmm. I got to say that Trollope also had a low opinion of Jamaica.
Because?
Yeah, I think he visited the place.
Did he really? Because I know, like, he went to Australia.
Yeah, I was like, well, you know, you visited British people in Jamaica. Of course, you're going to have an unpleasant time. And he said the infamous, I would fain forget Jamaica altogether.
Wow.
I was like, I hope you met the white people you were seeing there. Because
so basically, he didn't buy the postcard. He was not a fan. So, well, I mean, I can't speak for his...
I'm not necessarily, you know,
tourist point of
I'm
view.
Just trying to think of the Jamaica he would have seen. He wouldn't have been around any of the black folk. And the colonials were a pretty wretched sort. You know, they were kind of ill-bred. They probably spoke badly and smelled badly.
What were they like? Were they
if you are an English person or a British person in Jamaica in that period, were you pushed? Had you been pushed aside like Australia, like people were sent to Australia?
No, you're maybe in auto. Well, I don't. I mean, slavery would have been abolished a while ago. So you may, and a lot of the, you know, and a lot of the planters' families by 19th century didn't even live in Jamaica.
Right.
So chances are you weren't necessarily the most upper crust.
Right.
Person. So he would have met people who would have been unschooled, kind of ignorant, not very bright, and, you know, a little stunned because these are the people who go and saying that the black people are ignorant. Right. And he'd be like, no, you guys are pretty unwashed.
You're pretty awful. Yeah.
In fact, you smell bad. So he had a rotten time in Jamaica.
Well, as I said, what appeals to me about Trollope is that he wrote great political novels that, frankly, I have not seen in, for example, American fiction. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of Alan Drury, Advise and Consent, or those kind of 60s novels, which seem really shrill to me. But this was there. These are very, for me, there's very.
Drury is dreary.
Say that three times fast. The thing about
I say that we
the thing about Trollope for me with the political novels. Now I know you don't. He also wrote a lot about, like, you know, ecclesiastical life.
He wrote The Warden, which is one of the most boring books. That book made me go, eat it, Wharton. You know what? I'm going to reconsider you.
Okay.
I can't stand you.
All right, I had the same reaction to A Tale of Two Cities. It was the worst of times. It was the worst of times. I don't, you know what?
I'm not going to defend that book.
Well, you shouldn't. I mean, I will agree that Bleak House is one of the triumphs of English literature. I will agree with that. I do not want to see, hear, read, care about Charles Dickens writing about the French Revolution. I'm the only person on the planet who's read Great Expectations who didn't feel remotely interested in what happens to those people.
I'm about to walk out of this room right now.
I know.
That's like one of my foundational
novels. I know. It's one of your foundational texts. I get it.
Get out of here with your Warden.
Exactly.
Well, which I read twice because I had to do it for A-levels, and I still can't give you a synopsis of that book.
Well, I mean, the whole thing about that, you know, life within a cathedral close, it's not for everybody. It's not for the weak of heart. I grant you that. So I would not.
Not for the interested reader.
Well, I would not point you to that. I would point you to the 6 novels that I sent you as a Christmas gift to ask you to read. But so I'm Team Trollope, although I recognize Charles Dickens is a genius.
I think he's a genius. But I will say, I mean, my problem with Dickens is that Dickens sometimes never came across a sentimental scene that he wouldn't write.
Or never wrote a scene that did not have 5 extraneous paragraphs.
There you go again, Mr. Editor.
Well, sometimes
you got to weed through the chaff to get to the wheat. Okay, that's not what I meant to say, but I don't know how to say it better. of course, Bleak House is staggering. Great Expectation is great. Little Dorrit is fantastic.
I will agree. Little Dorrit is amazing.
David Copperfield, I cannot read. I keep trying.
Oh, interesting. You like, don't like that.
Okay. Old, like early Dickens when he's just a little too sentimental and pleased.
Did you read The Old Curiosity Shop?
Mm-mm.
Okay. That's the one, theoretically, the story goes, where people were standing on the wharf at New York Harbor when because it was, of course, published in yelling, what happened to Little Nell? What, and it's like, really? Is that actually, did that actually happen? Because that seems bogus to me. But
I don't know. Dickens was kind of a rock star.
Well, the Pickwick Papers, I remember, it was the first Dickens I read. I thought, this is 900 pages of wasted work.
Yeah, that I could have warned you about it. You should have read Nicholas Nickleby if you're going to read a big book.
Exactly. Or I actually even liked Our Mutual Friend.
That's a good book.
I did not like Dombey and Son.
I didn't read that one.
But
I keep trying with David Copperfield. Well, I just can't get into it.
You know what? Just admit it. It's you know, he can't write everything. Everything can't be perfect. I will agree. Bleak House is one of the 5 greatest novels written in English, which is a conversation for another podcast.
I was going to go, what are the other 4?
I was just going to say, stay tuned for more information. All right, let's jump to the other side of the Atlantic for another literary grudge match that I want to talk about here. This time, the gladiators, that's probably not the right word. Anyway, are women whose books have been read by countless children, and the stories have shown up on television and been turned into movies and have become part of the cultural landscape. Who we want to talk about are Laura Ingalls Wilder of the Little House books and Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Women, Little Men, and Joe's Boys. So explain to me why you like Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Laura Ingalls Wilder is that's a tough choice because, man, that girl sure was racist.
And dull.
And I totally supported that decision to change the name of that prize. I think it was a prize Laura Ingalls Wilder said, yeah, you should. It's like, why should we hold on to something that was wrong to begin with? If somebody's phone, it's like, people, like, I think there was this argument about it being too politically correct or so on. I'm like,
well,
no,
explain what happened.
I can't remember the name of the actual prize, but it was a Laura Ingalls Wilder Fiction Prize
given to a writer.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's a few years ago, they changed the name because it came out just how racist, particularly to Native Americans, Laura Ingalls Wilder was. And then the usual crowd were screaming censorship. And I'm like, dude, you're in America. You have no idea what censorship is.
Right.
It's like, there's a big difference between me blocking your freedom of speech and me blocking your access to making money. Mm-hmm. That all said, Laura Ingalls Wilder played such a titanic role in my young imagination.
So are you saying that as a young kid growing up in Jamaica, you happily read books about the Little House stories?
Well, for one, Little House may have been, if I remember, Little House was the first book that was not a picture book that I read. And I remember thinking, I thought this was one devious plot. Like, why wouldn't a book have pictures? That makes no sense. I remember my mom asking me, how are you liking the book? I'm like, well, there are no pictures, but it's okay. It's certainly the first book where after I read it, I tried to write a book.
So it was inspiration.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which I'm pretty sure my mom still has, and I'm pretty sure it's terrible.
Oh, I would pay big, big money to see this. I want to see Marlon James' first literary
I'm pretty sure
effort.
I don't. So... But it's for all the her flaws and for all that book's flaws, I still have to give it a special place of being the book that first made me want to write books.
Well, that's fair because, you know, there are certainly books that I have read that have affected me I read them at a particular time in my life, mm-hmm. and knowing that they're not very good or not very interesting or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I could never get away from with Laura Ingalls Wilder is these people are dull.
Mm-hmm.
They're living in a log cabin in the middle of nowhere, and the plot is, will we survive the winter?
Well, will we?
Well, 8 books later, the answer is yes. So I guess my point is, I wish there are certain books where you think, oh, you know what? The world in which you inhabit in a book is interesting, and I want to spend more time there. Could not wait to get out of that damn cabin.
You know what? Yeah, but I think part of the Laura Ingalls thing, and I think it's when did you read it? You remember?
Well, I read it later than you did.
Because I read it at a time Little House on the Prairie was a big hit TV show. So a huge part of it also is me recognizing the characters in the book.
Yes.
So I think a lot of the I'm trying to find a positive. What's the positive word for baggage? Because baggage has such negative connotations. A lot of the happy baggage that I put to that book was because of the TV show. So I don't know if it's because of that. It's like watching Spider-Man and reading a Spider-Man comic.
Right.
So I don't know if a lot of what I'm feeling is stuff I'm bringing to it, because to me it's not. It's no longer boring people. Right. Whoever played the dad?
Michael Landon.
It's Michael Landon.
See, I grew up in a Michael Landon free zone and was very happy for that.
You're so deprived.
Well, I mean, my parents never had any interest in Bonanza. I did not want to. I did not want to watch Little House on the Prairie. Not that anybody who did was somehow, you know, morally corrupt or whatever.
You're sounding kind of condescending.
I am sounding condescending, and that's kind of, that's because my choice, speaking of condescending,
was
my
I Claudius?
No.
I'm just talking about what you're watching on TV.
No, well, that's true.
Yeah, As for me, I was at the theater.
I was probably watching Upstairs, Downstairs. Yeah, that is pretty condescending. Anyway, my pick instead of Laura Ingalls Wilder is Louisa May Alcott. And the thing about that I find Louisa May Alcott is it's not that her prose is frankly any good. It's that she managed to figure out a way to write interestingly about young women at a time when it was really, really hard to find anything about women or that focused on women.
Certainly nothing about girls.
Exactly. That was not a cliche. And the thing about these four sisters who were coming together during the Civil War, whose father was off being a doctor for the Union Army, and this whole household of women were fighting against destruction. And you know, how are we going to put food on the table? How are we going to make sure that we are going to be okay as the winter goes? So, Little Women. I read in like the sequel, Little Men, which was later in the life of Jo and her husband, who started a school for boys. Actually, that was the first one I read that I really liked, and then the sequel to that, Jo's Boys. Mm-hmm. For me, Louisa May Alcott was more about the reason I like her is the story she tells. Unlike Laura Ingalls Wilder, seemed to me to show an evolution of. The culture as much as it showed the evolution of the characters. Mm. I could not get out of those big woods fast enough, yeah. As far as I was concerned.
Yeah, but evolution is kind of beyond Laura Ingalls Wilder's gifts.
She had many fine gifts.
Yeah. Evolution was one of them. Yeah. You know, she's born a racist, died a racist.
Well,
you know, it's Little Women to me, I don't know. I've read it and I remember liking it. I don't know if it's one of those books from that time that I always reach for. The book I used to really like was Lorna Dooney.
Oh, the Scottish, yeah. Walter Scott?
Yeah.
Now, my wife read that and really liked it.
Yeah.
I read 60 pages and said, that's enough. I'm done. Now, why do you like that
that's
one so
harsh. Much? I don't know. Maybe it's because I remember my first. So I went through these phases where I just read books constantly, like hundreds of books. And I remember.
Indiscriminately?
That, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I've always read indiscriminately. I think it's one of my favorite things about reading. this is why I don't have a snobbish attitude to books. But I remember reading that one because it was kind of intense and I was getting it. And when you're like 12 and you're reading a book that was definitely not meant for your age group, but you're digging it. And like, it's difficult, and I'm digging it. And that was one of those books for me. The other thing I want to think about Little Women is I think of how Geraldine Brooks managed to get a great novel out of that with March.
Oh, that's true. Yes, that's true. I remember watching the one I remember most is Susan Sarandon played Marmy. And
I might have seen that one.
And Winona Ryder played Jo. And it's actually really well done. And I'm not a huge Winona Ryder fan, and I'm less of a Susan Sarandon fan. So the fact that I liked both of them in it was kind of a cultural miracle. Coming up next is a part of the podcast we call Dead People, Dead Places, and Dead Things. These are aspects or details of the books or authors we were talking about that struck us as interesting or unusual or that we might have specialized knowledge about. So let's start with you again, Marlon. Mm-hmm. What do you want to talk about with either of the ladies and gentlemen we discussed?
I think, you know, for all my issues with Dickens, I am still pretty much convinced that Dickens invented childhood. In the sense that until Dickens, one, I don't think children played such a huge role in literature. And two, I don't think society played much attention to children.
I think that's true.
I think the whole idea that a child could have an interior life and that a child, that to abuse a child is wrong, to put a child in labor camps, the whole idea of exploiting particularly poor children until they're dead is something nobody thought about until Dickens. It's like nobody thought about the food we ate until Upton Sinclair.
Right.
And I think that the type of world he uncovered, the type of Britain he uncovered, is something that they've never seen before.
Well, 175 years ago, or whenever it was that he was writing, childhood did not exist the way we thought about it.
Yeah.
Or think about it. I mean, the idea of, you know, being a 6-year-old kid and going out to play or sitting at home and reading a book or playing a video game or whatever, though it was like you were in the family to actually keep it together, mm-hmm. help it to survive. And if you fell into the fire at 2 or 3 years old and burned to death, that's kind of on you.
It's kind of on you. You should be seen and not heard.
Exactly. And working your ass off mm-hmm. in order to make sure that the rest of the family, which is why one of the reasons, you know, families, they had so many children. It's mm-hmm. like these were actual assets for survival.
Yeah. And it's, if you are a family, say before 1910 mm-hmm. and you had 4 kids, it meant 7 died.
Yes. And I can speak to my own family. I mean, I have, my grandparents and great-grandparents, they had like 4 children who died over mm-hmm. the course of the reproductive life of my great-grandmother. And it was, you know, you sort of read these kind of litanies of, you know, this baby was born and they were always named the same and they mm-hmm. just kept dying. And you think, how did you go through this?
Yeah.
How did you survive this?
I think they took it as a given. But I think, yeah, Dickinson's London had never been seen before, and I think he was very good at highlighting the parts that British people, Londoners, even the rest of the world, would rather not look at.
Well, even something like Oliver Twist, mm-hmm. Which I really liked because it was talking about, you know, Fagin's band of children,
yeah.
and you know, who worked as thieves.
With that, a little dosage of anti-Semitism,
absolutely, as the, you know, nice Jewish man that Fagin was. Mm-hmm. But the idea that somehow children were, as you said, had interior lives or mm-hmm. ideas or pasts that could actually have an impact on their futures.
Yeah, and I think he did a huge service to the world with that. I don't think, that's why I said, I think Dickens invented childhood.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting, actually. Well, what I want to talk about is, I think one of the things about Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, and one of the reasons she became one of the sort of great names in American literature, was because she wanted to help out her father.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1860s, there was an editor at a publishing house named Thomas Niles who asked if Alcott would write a book for and about girls. And mm-hmm. she didn't really want to do that. She sort of considered herself a tomboy. Her sexual preference is not part of this conversation, but she was a tomboy. She never married. She never had children. As far as I know, she never had a significant relationship with anyone, either male or female. But she wanted to sort of get excited about the project, but she sort of couldn't really muster that much enthusiasm for it. On the other hand, her father, a guy named Amos Bronson Alcott, who was a transcendentalist and a minister, and he was trying to convince Niles to publish his manuscript on philosophy, which even back then was a hard sell to mm-hmm. an editor. So anyway,
there goes my next book.
Please, please, please go. So Louisa May Alcott's father told Niles that he would get his daughter to write a book about girls if he would publish his novel, his book on philosophy, I mean. And Louisa May Alcott agreed. So she wrote Little Women based on her sisters and their experiences. So the book was an enormous success, and her father's book got published. So it was kind of a quid pro quo.
I guess his book wasn't an enormous
his
success.
His book did not star Winona Ryder and Susan Sarandon.
He's not the William James to her Henry.
No, not by no means. But it's the sort of things like, you know what, Dad? I'll do this for you. And that's kind of, it's a kind of an intellectual and creative sacrifice that I don't know if a lot of people would have made. And so props to her for doing that, particularly given the fact that her father had been within the kind of transcendentalist mix, and she had family friends. It was, you know, Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne were all part, and Melville, I think, were all part of the sort of family unit or family group that she grew up in. So she was kind of in this world of ideas, and she wrote what became an enormously popular and an enormously kind of personal book that people found personal because it was about young women.
I remember reading, it was an article, it was an excerpt from a book, because one of the bones in contention that we've had about 19th century literature is where the 19th century American female novelists.
Yes.
You know, we have Wharton, we have so on. And one of the things that this article or this book was arguing, and I thought it was a good argument, was that American women just didn't have the time. That that a lot of British, like a lot of, like I know it because it's a tradition in Jamaica where, for example, I grew up with a household, a housekeeper. And every time I mention it to Americans, they go, oh, you were rich. Yeah. I was like, no, even a poor, a sort of lower income family would still have a house servant or a housemaid or whatever. And it's not necessarily that you're worthless or you have money. It's just kind of a deal you work out where it's like, I'll help my cousin in the country to come to the city and live. She takes care of the children.
And because there's a lot of stuff that needs to be taken care of. It's not like you can, you know, you can't pop dinner into the microwave and send the laundry out to be washed and then dash to the, and then wait for the delivery from the grocery store on what it is you're
and you know doing. You know of your house servant, but it's one of those British traditions that never really came over to the States, but it came over to places like Jamaica or India or so on. And but the argument the writer is making is that there were more British women novices because they just had the time.
Oh wow! So it's both a class issue in terms of people who can have.
But also class, education.
Education, yeah.
And so on. I thought it was a really interesting thing because the question is always, where are the American female novelists in the 19th century?
Well, as you said, somebody like Edith Wharton, who comes from the upper class, and is there somebody else?
I don't know. I go back and forth on that woman because she's a snob first, novelist second.
Well, that's true, but you can also say, you know, somebody else is, you know, and I can't think of a good example right now, but it's a little bit like saying, okay, Gore Vidal is a public intellectual first and a novelist second. Does that demote his novels?
No, but snob, I don't know.
I mean, obviously snob is much more pejorative than something like public intellectual.
I mean, so was Forster. I think Forster was a snob first, novelist second.
So you're not a fan of Forster?
I'm not a fan of Maurice. That's a piece of shit.
No, that is not good. That is not
good. Then again, even he kind of knew it.
Well, that's the one that he didn't publish in his lifetime.
That's one he didn't publish. It's the one where the movie's definitely better than
movie.
The book.
Oh, that's incorrect. Well, that's a subject for another podcast. Movies that are better than the books.
Come on, it's Hugh Grant kissing a dude. In the meadow.
Where's the downside
with
that?
His hair is sensational.
Okay, this is another conversation, but Hugh Grant.
I can't believe we're not going to talk about the gorgeousness of Hugh Grant.
Well, Hugh Grant is, I'm sure, a very fine actor. Hugh Grant acts a lot with his hair.
Whoa, that is some shit.
Well, I don't wish him ill. I'm not saying he's...
I'm going to say, as a white person, I am pretty impressed with your shade right now. For a white person, that is some serious shade.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Wow.
You're welcome. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to shade up with my black friends.
Well, I mean, literally, there was a period of time when I went to a fair number of movies that had Hugh Grant in them. Everything from Sense and Sensibility to Love Actually and to About a Boy, which I actually think is a great movie.
I love that movie.
Yeah. And the novel's actually even better. Anyway, my point is, it was like, oh, wait, I spent more time thinking about Hugh Grant's hairstyle than I did about how he got through the movie. And I'm not sure
what your problem is. Hair is important.
Hair is crucial. This is a lesson we want you all to learn. All right, let's move on to what we call the warmest, fuzziest part of the show, which is a segment we call I Don't Give Two Shakes of a Rat's Ass What You Think. This is where each of us makes a case for a book or author that we know the other one probably won't agree with, but we want to stand by it anyway. So what do you want to share today,
Mark? No, I think you should go first.
Do you want me to go first? All right. I've been thinking a lot about the creepiness and the sort of domestic horror that is Stuart Little. Stuart Little starts out perfectly reasonably as this young couple, or this couple in New York, who have a son named George, and they give birth to a 3-inch tall white mouse that they name Stuart. And that seems perfectly reasonable within the context of this novel.
That was a very easy labor. I'm just saying.
Okay, the interspecies problems, notwithstanding, to the logic of this particular
thing. You're sounding speciesist.
I totally am in this case. And then the fact that we go through this whole story, and then George, the older brother, just tosses Stuart down the tub drain. And mom and dad have difficulty finding him. He's in the drain. So you kind of think there's a lot of psychosis going on in this perfectly
reasonable family. If my little brother is a rat,
you're going to throw him down.
I'm probably going to throw him down the drain. It's okay. Like I kind of vermin for a brother.
Well, and I agree with you, but the other part of this is nobody seems to sort of say, "Hey, there's a mouse running around this neighborhood, family."
I told you, I was saying before, it reminds me of the late, great Cow and Chicken.
Yes.
Cow and Chicken cartoon.
Cow and Chicken cartoon.
Yes, it was, as I said, it was good. What, mama had a chicken, mama had a cow, dad was so happy you didn't ask how.
And they say good poetry isn't written anymore, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Well, what do you have today?
I don't care what anybody thinks, but I will go to my grave saying John Steinbeck is a better author than Ernest Hemingway.
Well, okay. I could not agree with you more, but why God do you
damn
think?
It.
I know, exactly. You were trying to be provocative, and I agree.
I even kept it from you.
I know, you totally did. Why do you think?
You're still not being a good American editor right now.
Well, okay. First of all, Hemingway wrote three stories that he turned into a career and a Nobel Prize in Literature. The thing, at least about Steinbeck, is he was willing to write about somebody besides himself.
He was so good at writing about people beside, not himself. And he's a creature of his time, so some of those books have not aged well. I'm kind of scared to go back to The Pearl.
Okay, yeah, you're better not.
I'm probably going to stay away from that for a little bit. But I have, you know, Grapes of Wrath, of course, East of Eden, which is better than people think, including better than what he thought.
Okay, because I love The Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah.
East of Eden I have not read recently.
I should go back to it. Cannery Row, Tortilla Flat. It's. I just think, for one, Steinbeck plays a bigger role in my childhood than Hemingway. Because a lot of those books I read as a kid. I read Cannery Row. I read East of Eden. I read a lot of these books growing up. And I remember thinking this was like the type of serious novel that I could understand. And I also think he's just a warmer writer.
Well, he cares about people.
Yeah, and I don't think Hemingway cared about people.
He cared about himself.
Yeah. What is his name? Pasternak has this interview. I think it was a Paris Review interview, and he was talking about usually the feud is Hemingway versus Faulkner.
Right.
Which for me, Faulkner wins hands down.
Hemingway versus Fitzgerald.
That one I might give to Hemingway.
Oh, I totally give to Fitzgerald.
Yeah? I don't know. I have to go back and read the crack up.
Actually, well, the crack up is good. I was surprised. I reread The Last Tycoon recently. Mm-hmm. It's flawed, certainly. I was surprised how much I liked it.
I might go back to that because I to me, in a lot of ways, Great Gatsby notwithstanding, in a lot of ways, Fitzgerald is a 19th century author.
Oh, absolutely. He's basically a romantic.
Which is funny because to me, Great Gatsby was the first thing that the 20th century has happened.
Yes, because in a way, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, you know what? Hope is dead.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
So the good post-World War I.
Absolutely. But, anyway, back but, to...
Well, Pasternak said, you know, he understands why people think Hemingway is great. But he says, as for me, I'm not going to get a drink and sit down to read about people getting a drink to sit down. I was like, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Boris has better things to do with his time. Yes.
It's like, if one more person drinks a sort of star anise or whatever it is they always drink, it's always a cocktail.
Right. Well, I mean, I read early in college and couldn't, it was like fingernails against a chalkboard, the Nick Adams stories, which is about basically Ernest Hemingway growing up and thinking deep thoughts within the northern Michigan woods. And there was a scene in one of them where Nick Adams, basically trails his hand in the river and he's in a canoe and he thought he would never die. And I thought, you know, if you're going to be that obvious, why don't you just hit me with a 2x4 and be done with it? Now, I may be misremembering this, but the profound memory I have of all this is like, you know, I just read 260 pages of the same story over and over again, and I'm ready to move on. I will say Ernest Hemingway, in my opinion, wrote one perfect short story. And that is the short story, Hills Like White Elephants.
That is a perfect short story. And I teach it every year.
Do you really? Okay. Mm. How do the students respond?
Actually, it depends. It depends on some students are found it boring. Some students are like,
boring. Or they it's think six pages it's, long.
Or they think it's boring. Then I kind of unlock it and I go, whoa. Yeah. I was like, yeah, the things that Hemingway is good at, he is the master.
Yes. He's much better. I mean, he was obviously the king of less, mm-hmm. but when he actually uses less almost like a scalpel as opposed to like a, you know, a headline, it can be quite poignant actually.
And also when Hemingway uses less than add that one detail or two, like in Hills Like White Elephants, when the girl always looks away instead of answering a question.
Exactly.
You know, I was saying, you know, Hemingway gets all this credit for being the king of objective point of view, but he breaks it twice in Hills Like White Elephants. I'll give it a weekend to figure it out, and whoever figures it out gets extra credit. They usually don't, but
well, the thing that I remember reading it completely, you know, kind of stumbling across it in the collection of short stories, and I actually got choked up.
Yeah.
I mean, by myself, this is 30 years ago, thinking, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I get this.
Didn't he write, was it, there's a Nick Adams story. Is it The Light of the World or one of them? I can't remember. It's when Nick goes to the bar and a bartender wouldn't serve him.
Oh, yes. I do. I don't remember the name of it, though. Yes, I do remember the story.
I actually don't remember it. I just know I teach parts of it.
Well, now, do you teach Steinbeck at all?
I teach Travels with Charlie.
Okay.
What else have I taught? I haven't taught him in a while because he has some I'm teaching 19-year-olds. They need short novels. So Grapes of Wrath is not going to happen.
No, true. Have you ever taught them, and this is completely off topic, have you ever taught them Invisible Cities, the Italo Calvino book?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Pro tip. Teach them.
That's Invisible way City. Off topic, Jake.
It is. It's totally off topic. And time for another podcast. Okay. I think that's all for today. So thank you for listening all the way to the end. We would be interested in hearing from you. So feel free to send us your feedback, your love notes to Marlon, your ideas at wereaddeadpeople@prh.com. Recognizing, of course, that whatever we hear from you, we will judge you on. So
Jake will judge because he's an editor. He judges everything.
I judge everything.
After this, we do a podcast on living authors, which will never air until we're both dead.
Exactly.
Because most of them are friends of mine.
I was just going to say, you know far too many. You know far too many living authors. If you enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll subscribe to us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. And another shameless plug, don't forget to rate this podcast, as it will help more people discover Marlon's melodious voice and my inability to end a sentence.
I'm so glad he didn't call it lyrical.
I think melodious is better.
Yeah, I prefer melodious. Yes.
So you can follow Read It Forward and Riverhead Books on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram for updates on all things books, all of them written by living authors, of course. So we'll have
Melania is pretty dead.
Really?
Yeah, as far as I know, unless it's like Tupac.
True. And we'll have links in the show notes to all the books that we've talked about today. So until next time, go read some dead people and some live people.
Listening to Marlon and Jake means my to-read list gets longer every week. Enter Libro FM. Libro FM lets me purchase audiobooks directly from my favorite local bookstore. I can pick from more than 185,000 titles, including bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers. I get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But I'm part of a different story, one that supports community. And you can be too. Marlon and Jake Read Dead People listeners can get a special offer. two audiobooks for the price of one with your first month of membership. That's two audiobooks for just $14.99 with the code Marlin and Jake. Visit Libro.fm to get started. Now go read some dead people. Offer only valid for new members in Canada and the U.S.